Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Oh, hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. The reason we're all laughing is because we're talking about my editing moment last night when I decided to have breakfast before going to bed. fortunately, tonight is a very different night because a team has won a Davis Cup finals tie in straight sets, meaning we're recording well before midnight and we don't really know what to do with ourselves. However, here we are.
Speak for yourself, David.
Not for Matt.
What time is it? My clock says 9:48. Is that correct?
No, that was about 3 hours ago.
Oh, crikey. So what time is it there, Matt?
It's half past midnight for Matt.
Okay, well, I'll be having breakfast again soon. So anyway.
No point in wasting a good intro, though.
Yeah, but for sounding good to me, Rafael Nadal and Roberto Bautista Agut have combined to win the Davis Cup final, which doesn't sound quite right, but apparently it's correct, or the World Championship match, as I also read it called earlier today. And they've lifted the trophy.
Well, that can get in the bin along with clutch.
They didn't lift the trophy because the trophy is the size of a truck, but they lifted the little silver bit that goes on top of the rest of the trophy.
Which I have a story about that.
Oh, yeah.
So everyone here calls the Davis Cup the salad bowl trophy, because in all the newspapers, the kind of second, you know, when they don't want to repeat themselves by saying the Davis Cup again, they call it the salad bowl. And apparently,
what's salad bowl in Spanish?
Ensaladera. And
always sounds better when he says it in Spanish, doesn't it?
And apparently, it's some kind of urban, well, not urban, Davis Cup legend myth. That Dwight Davis, who started the Davis Cup, needed a trophy, and he took his grandmother's salad bowl to use as the trophy. I believe that has been discarded, but it's quite a nice story, and it does look a bit like a salad bowl on the top of the Davis Cup.
But how do you account for the wedding cake bit underneath it?
Yeah, pass.
Okay. More research than Matt Roberts to do in 2020.
I have half a story about the Davis Cup to be continued.
And so, folks, if we are successfully crowdfunded for 2020, these are the sort of things we'll be getting Matt Roberts to do, given that we give him a job again. Right, we better talk about what actually happened. Before we do, just to mark your card on the rest of what's coming up in this final daily edition of the Tennis Podcast for 2019, we have gone to town, or rather Matt Roberts has. We're going to be hearing from Rafael Nadal in the press conference straight afterwards. We're going to be hearing from Gerard Piquet, who gave a press conference this morning about the future of the Davis Cup. We're going to hear Matt giving a grilling to the ITF chief, David Haggerty. You're going to be hearing that here on the Tennis Podcast. And you're also going to be hearing from a good friend of ours, one of our favourite colleagues, Christopher Clary from the New York Times. Matt's been speaking to him, and it's just so fascinating to get the view of somebody who's been covering Davis Cup since the 80s. And there isn't really a voice in tennis, I think, that I look forward to the view of more than him, because he's going to have thought of something that I know I haven't thought of. And that was the case again in Matt's conversation with him. So we'll have that coming up. But first, folks, what a performance from those two players. First of all, when it was revealed that Félix Auger-Aliassime was going to be drafted in for his first appearance on a tennis court in 6.5 weeks, I read, to be playing against a guy who was mourning the passing of his father from 3 days ago, and has been obviously ever since, and he was going to be the single selection. I filled up. I mean, I felt really emotional about just the mere prospect of that. Admittedly, I haven't had an awful lot of sleep the last couple of days, and things probably are getting to me a bit more than they normally would. But I can't really imagine how he did that, Baptiste Rogut, just to even commit to it. And yet at the same time, I can kind of see why he did it. It's a bit like when people say it's best to keep busy sometimes. I don't know. I mean, everybody's situation is different, isn't it? And there is no one way to grieve. But the way he did what he did, handled himself, won the match. I mean, he beat Félix Auger-Aliassime, for goodness sake. And then the scenes of him celebrating and being with his teammates, I found it incredibly moving.
Difficult to find the words, isn't it?
Yeah, I just thought it was one of the most extraordinary things I've seen on a tennis court, to be honest. I think there's such a danger with a player like Baptiste Rogut. We will very often use words about his game maybe as a bit robotic or a bit mechanical in a way, because that, you know, his tennis, that the pure bones of his tennis is a bit like that. But, you know, he is a human, a person going through just the most difficult emotions, and for him to be able to deal with everything that he's been through and channel it into that performance, I thought was one of the bravest things that I've seen in a long time. It was really, really moving, and everyone in the stadium knew his story. You could tell there was such warmth, such love towards him, and you know, there was absolutely no sense that anyone was forcing him to do this. I think it was very much his own decision. I can imagine, I don't know the team conversations that would have happened, but I can imagine they were all saying, look, you don't have to play Roberto, but you almost get the sense that he just wanted to, as you said, to kind of deal with it in his own way. And, you know, he's already had a lot of amazing tennis achievements this year, Baptiste Rogut. I think, you know, he's beaten Djokovic a couple of times, made a Wimbledon semi-final, been at, you know, he was a bit of a star at the Australian Open, cracked the top 10. But what he did today was bigger than tennis. It was really moving.
There was a slight hint of irony to it, because and I feel like there was another incident of this year, but, you know, obviously he was a key participant in that match that Andy Murray played at the Australian Open, where, well, we now know foolishly Andy Murray was sort of essentially retired after it, and we all sort of lamented the fact at the time that Baptiste Rogut had been handed this role as the villain in it, you know, just a MacGuffin in the emotional torrent story that was Andy Murray at the time. And of course, what Roberto Baptiste Rogut has gone through this week is very different, and I'm not comparing it to the, you know, physical strife of Andy Murray, but we talked at the time about it feeling completely unjust that it was Roberto Baptiste Rogut that had to take on that role, because he's not just a MacGuffin or a robot or a, you know, a participant. He's a lot more than that, and sort of deserves his own story. And You know, it's not the story you would have wanted, but my goodness me, was it a torrent of emotion on his side of the court today.
And also, at the end of it, he as well as being emotional, he said, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else right now than doing what I'm doing. And, you know, that was great to see. And what a performance. What a performance he put in. Straight sets. He lived with this young lad all the way through that first set, and then he just took over. Fantastic performance, and then that set the platform for Nadal.
Very, very tough for Felix Auger-Aliassime today. I really felt for him. You know, it was Bautista Agut's role against Murray in Australia multiplied by 1,000, if not more.
And when they put Felix Auger-Aliassime in the team this afternoon, I was thinking perhaps this is going to be his moment, because I still feel like for all we know about Auger-Aliassime, and we've seen his rise, he hasn't really had a standout moment yet. He hasn't done what Shapovalov did, beating Nadal in Montreal, or what Kyrgios did, beating Nadal at Wimbledon, that kind of thing. He hasn't had that one standout result yet. Now, it will come, I'm sure, but I wondered whether it would be today. But then as soon as the match kind of started and it got underway, you realised this was not an ordinary match, not an ordinary situation. It was difficult for him, I think, as well, given the background. And yeah, so he's still waiting for that, really. But all credit to Bautista Agut. I mean, I didn't think I could have more respect for him as both a athlete, tennis player, also as a person. He's been one of the most supportive tennis players of LGBT rights on tour. He's a good guy, and I think he's been through a hell of a lot, because he also lost his mother, I think, in 2016. So, you know, you just really feel for him on a day like this, and I am pleased for him that he got the win, and he did seem to get, you know, some joy out of it.
And actually, it was noticeable that Nadal made a beeline for him as soon as he got off the floor, having won, and just picked him up off his feet.
Yeah,
Nadal has, I think all the team did, but Nadal, I think, has a really human quality where it comes to connecting with people, both in the stands and on a personal basis with his friends. He sort of takes over in order to make people feel comfortable, and he kind of knows what to do in a given situation, I feel, with people. And that's what he did there. And his performance today, he was pushed by Shapovalov in the second set. In the first set, I think probably Shapovalov was a little tight, and he couldn't really put a finger on Nadal. Early break, that was kind of it. Second set, I think Nadal got a bit tight, but Shapovalov just did what we all know he's capable of doing. And I hesitate to say should have won the set, because I said that yesterday about the second set of the doubles. The fact is, Nadal's winning these sets. So if he should have lost them, he would have lost them. He rips them out of the grasp of players, in truth. And that's what he did again here.
Yeah, it was a slightly strange atmosphere in the stadium, I thought, for the Nadal match. Perhaps I was just comparing it to the last two Nadal matches that I'd seen, where Spain had been 1-0 down, and it was all on Nadal to get them back in the tie. So there was some jeopardy, whereas today it kind of felt like people were just expecting Nadal to win, and this was going to be a bit of a coronation, and that was the case in the first set, and it was up to Shapovalov to change the mood in the stadium, and to his immense credit, he did that. Started swinging, started getting into Nadal's service games, and really rocked him. The mood just began to change. People got a bit more anxious, and yet every time there was a big point, Nadal raised his game and saved his best for those moments, because I think he was a little bit short on energy, understandably. This was his eighth match in 6 days. He was starting to drop the ball a bit short, and you know, it just wasn't quite the force on his ground strokes that there had been all week. And he needed to get through that second set, I think, just otherwise it could have become really complicated. But yeah, I mean, see yesterday's podcast for praise about Nadal. I think everything we said, you know, stands today as well. He's just, he is extraordinary. And what he has done this week is up there with, I think, some of his best achievements. I really do. The way he has played just relentlessly, just made it such a mission for him, for himself.
Let's hear from him talking after winning that Davis Cup title.
It's a victory that I'm very happy because I played against one of the toughest opponents possible, and after a very, very long and tough week for me physically and mentally too, no? Because the energy that I tried to put in every single moment on the whole event have been all the things, all what I have inside me. And honestly, it's the perfect end of the season for all of us. No, we know how difficult it is to win this trophy, and we know how difficult it's going to be to keep winning in the future. And we knew that we need to convert this opportunity, no? And we fought very hard. And what Roberto did today is out of this planet, in my opinion. But as I said the other day, our team is great. I don't see a lot of teams that all five players take part on the competition, and everybody of us played a match at least, and that makes this competition even more special because everybody of our team participate in the victory.
So Rafael Nadal, I feel underlining, confirming just how deep he has to dig. And I remember that was my immediate reaction after the US Open final when he withstood the Medvedev comeback, despite having kind of got tight himself. He's a human being, he gets nervous, and yet he will stare that down and find a way. And I don't really know how he does that. I mean, that's something for certain kinds of people. There aren't that many out there. I compare it to Olympians like Chris Hoy and Steve Redgrave, who will find a level of pain that they're prepared to take in order to keep on going and get over the line. And only the very best sports people have that. I mean, I think there are people, obviously, in other walks of life who do it all the time, you know, withstand incredible stress, and whether it be physical or mental or emotional. And within the normally comfy, cozy surroundings of sport, Nadal goes places that are very much not comfy and cozy in order to win.
Yeah, in the words of Mary Carrillo earlier today, she said the best part of Nadal is his great beating heart, the only body part that will never betray him.
Oof.
That's it, isn't it? I've had all day to try and think of a way to say that in my own words that would be as good or a bit better, and I don't have it in me, so I've just read that out word for word.
Well, when we've got Mary Carrillo on tap these days, it's amazing. So we tap into it, believe me. It was just fantastic. And it just, I mean, look, in the end, we're going to hear now in a minute from Gerard Piquet, David Haggerty, and then we'll talk to Chris Clary. But I mean, they got what they wanted, didn't they? They have got this Davis Cup format change off to a cracking start because it was held in Spain. Spain won. Nadal was there. Nadal was the winning moment. It couldn't really have gone better for them in terms of script writing.
No, I agree with that. I think it's been a great success. I have enjoyed it immensely. And perhaps we should hear from David Haggerty before we come on to this. I do worry about complacency a bit. I don't think it helps anyone to deny the problems, the faults with it. I think year two is going to be incredibly crucial because you can forgive the faults with it being essentially an experimental year. But next year, the forgiveness threshold will be far, far lower.
Yeah, this paper's over the cracks a bit, doesn't it, really? The fact that we've had this incredible end, and there have been many other wonderful moments that I think make this event and this format one that I hope succeeds in the long run, because I think that they've got something. They have got something here we've had an incredible week of sport. It just has so much further to go. And they've got to iron out so many things here. Now, the man who's in charge of it all, ultimately, is Gerard Piqué, because his company, his marketing company, Comp Cosmos, have bought the Davis Cup. They own it, they run it, obviously in conjunction with the ITF, but basically they've bought the rights to it. And this guy is a world-renowned and world-class footballer for Barcelona. He's very much still in the height of his career. I mean, it's quite a thing that he's doing to be juggling these two things while he's still an active athlete. And he came into press today, spoke for half an hour in Spanish and English alongside David Haggerty. Matt was there recording the press conference. We've taken a couple of the answers here that just give you a bit of an insight into what Gerard Piqué, his outlook is, particularly in terms of moving forward, because he wants things to change next year.
I think that in the future, we said it, ITF and Cosmos, we are really open to sit down with the ATP and try to arrive to a deal to make a unique competition, a super event of 2 weeks, and try to find the best spot in the calendar. I think that during this week, Novak and Rafa, two number one and number two in the world right now, have expressed that they want the same. They want just one event, and if it's possible to put it in September of 2 weeks. And this is something that for us, I mean, since day one, we expressed that we want to arrive to this deal. I think it's the best for tennis. It makes no sense to have right now two different competitions that are very similar, and this is the way we're going. We are very happy that in the next few months, I think we will start talking again with the ATP, and I hope in the next few months we can announce something.
At the moment, Cosmos are not investing in the Fed Cup. Is that something that is of interest to you?
Yeah, for sure. And since day one, I think that we showed interest to the ITF. What we said to them is obviously we wanted to go step by step, and Davis Cup on itself, it was a big project. We didn't want to try to do too much, because then you don't do things right. And at the end of the day, ITF decided to go to for the next 3 years to Budapest. Yeah. So for us now, we are fully focused on try to year by year make this competition and this event even better and bigger. And in 3 years, let's see where we are.
So he wants a September date. That's going to be interesting. He wants 2 weeks. He certainly spoke there in answer to Russell Fuller's question in the longer term of wanting to involve Fed Cup and have a mixed event. Just generally, what do you think of what you've heard from Gerard Piqué? I mean, I think you've met him as well, Catherine, haven't you?
I think he's very impressive, really impressive. I really think his love of and care for tennis is very genuine. I mean, obviously he's a businessman and has financial incentives that go along with that, but I do believe he cares about tennis. I think there are questions to be asked about things he says. You know, I find the party line from Piqué and from Haggerty, we'll hear about Fed Cup. The question that Russell posed there to Piqué, and Matt, you posed exactly the same question to Haggerty. You know, it's money where your mouth is, isn't it? At the end of the day, they haven't invested in Fed Cup, and I think everybody knows that if they had wanted to, that would have been greeted with open arms. So Fed Cup has been neglected in favour of Davis Cup. Those are the facts. So I don't just accept everything he says simply because I find him personable and impressive. But I do find him personable and impressive. And, you know, with some hesitations, I think I'm willing to embrace him as a factor in tennis. You know, he's investing in the sport. I'd love it if he were investing in Fed Cup too, and yeah, in a lot of other things. But I think by and large, he is a force for good in tennis.
Certainly, I think from what we've seen so far, and I guess time will tell in the long run, including how financially viable all this ends up being, whether it is going to be sustainable in the long run.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Now, mentioned that Matt spoke to David Haggerty. That was shortly after that press conference. And Matt starts by asking him how he feels the week has gone.
The finals, it's been a very successful week. I think we have a great foundation to build on for future years. We've had over 130 spectators, fans that have come. The top players are here. We have 87 players from around the world. Been some fantastic matches, some great environments. I think last night watching Spain play it was a fantastic, against Great Britain, was a fantastic match, great atmosphere. But we've had that all throughout the week in the group stages. So having the top players here, having the media coverage around the world, everyone knows this week that it's the Davis Cup Finals, where in previous years it might just have been two nations that were aware of it and the rest of the world perhaps not.
Are there any aspects you think you've got wrong?
I don't think there's anything that we see that we've gotten wrong. I think there are a number of areas that we can improve, and I think that that's what we'll be doing. We'll be doing evaluations, talking to the players, talking to their entourage, talking to media, fans, to see what we can do better and how we can improve it. Scheduling is always a challenge, and that's an area that we'll be looking at. Is it another court? Is it starting at different times? Is it, you know, who knows what it will be, but we'll have a thorough evaluation that we'll be going through over the next few weeks and in order to make the 2020 Davis Cup Finals even better.
Just on some of the other things that you perhaps could improve on, you've mentioned the scheduling there. Are there any other specific areas? I think I'm thinking maybe of the TV deals with our listeners. We've had a lot in the US talking about how it's just been difficult to watch it. I'm also talking about things like the Davis Cup app, which didn't really work. Do you see them as just teething problems that you can iron out?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think these are a couple of the areas that we can make improvements. I mean, with the app and the website, I don't think we expected as much traffic as we had, and we thought we had the capacity, but it was slow. There were some programming things we had to change midway through. So absolutely, the app and the website is something that we're looking at. And again, broadcast around the world. I think that this was year one. We had some broadcasters who weren't as interested, didn't understand what it would be. Now, with what we've had here and the success that we've had, I think we'll be looking at those broadcast deals and our partners around the world to be able to make sure it can be seen in every country in the way that we want it to be. So I think those are a couple of areas. There might be others. I mean, that's why we want to do the evaluation and hear what else could be better so we can make those improvements.
In terms of the atmosphere, obviously Davis Cup is renowned for its amazing atmospheres and passionate fans. That has been the case in quite a lot of the matches, but it's also been true that certainly earlier on in the week, the stadiums were not particularly full. It didn't necessarily always feel like Davis Cup in there. How can you improve on that going forward?
Well, I think that one of the things that we're doing is working with the nations, because the fans and the supporters coming from those nations are what bring that atmosphere. I mean, tonight we'll see with Canada and you know, a couple hundred followers that they have, they will make a lot of noise, and that's what the players want. And we've had some players who have said that if not as many fans have traveled, they've said, you know, we need our fans to be here. We're at a disadvantage when we play another country that has their fans. So I think those are areas that we'll look at. And again, I have to remember that we start on a Monday morning at 11 o'clock. And, you know, if you're at any tennis event around the world at 11 o'clock in early in the week, you know, you don't always have as much of a crowd. But what we do know is Madrid loves tennis. So I think there's better marketing, some things that we can do, and also working with the countries, because it's important that the nations travel and their fans come. And because of the success this week, we've already had nations writing to us saying, can we get tickets early now for next year? How do we get them? Because we want more of our fans to travel. So I think 2020 will show great improvements in these areas.
So just to clarify, you think that some of the money can go to the nations, the federations, in terms of trying to subsidize some travel, the cost of tickets for fans, so that large support groups can travel to Madrid next year?
Well, the Davis Cup finals generates significant revenue that goes back to the nations in the form of development grants. So I think the nations have the money to be able to encourage more fans. I think everyone was looking to see what the first year would be like, and now that everyone sees, for instance, Great Britain purchased 800 tickets yesterday. Andy sent something out on Twitter, and a lot of people responded, and they came. It's the same sort of thing that we could be doing everywhere, but doing it further in advance to make sure that the, you know, the fans are able to come. So absolutely, those will be important changes.
I just wanted to pick up on a few thoughts that have occurred to me throughout the week, and some things that have come up with the competition, in terms of its credibility. I'm thinking, firstly, just about the issue with the walkover that Canada gave in the doubles, and then Australia did something similar in the doubles. Do you think that knocked the credibility of this event? It was quite fortunate that it didn't end up having an impact, perhaps. And how confident can you be that you will have changed the rules next year so that something like that can't happen again?
Well, I think 119 years says there's a little bit of credibility to the competition. So I don't agree that this in any way damages the credibility. We have rules in place. The rules were not broken, but that means we can look at the rules and see if there are modifications. And again, this is one of the areas that's already been discussed. I'm sure there'll be a change in how we do that, because you know, Davis Cup is important, and we want to make sure that the best teams are the teams that get through. What happened had no impact on the results, as you said. So again, I think it's a learning, and each year this happens. I mean, you see it. That's why the rules of tennis change each year, to adapt to some new challenge that might come forward.
And what about wildcards? Why do you have them? The slogan for this tournament has been the World Cup of tennis. In other sports, in World Cups, the host nation would get a wild card, but not others. So can you explain what the purpose of those wild cards is, and does it not seem a bit unfair?
Actually, I think the wild cards give us the ability, as you say, for the host nation. So in the Fed Cup competition in Budapest, Hungary has the ability to have a wild card. Spain, if they hadn't qualified, would have had the opportunity to have a wild card as well. Since they've qualified by being in the finals, it gives us the opportunity to look at other teams and make some decisions based on what the steering committee believes is the right thing to do, and that's what we've done. I think there's no surprise in having a nation like France, the number one ranked team in the Davis Cup competition, have a wild card into the finals, and Serbia, one of the top teams with top player in the world as well. So again, I think we've had a lot of positive feedback on those two choices.
And how long is the intention to hold it in Spain? I know that it's confirmed in Madrid for next year. What is the situation looking like beyond that? And do you think that that potentially is a problem for the competition if it stays in Spain long term? We've seen Spain having obviously a lot more support here than other teams. Again, taking the example of a World Cup, World Cups move around every edition, they're in a different place. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that for now the intention is we're here in Madrid for 2 years. We wanted to finish this year's edition. We'll start a bid process to talk about future years and where we could be. We've had interest from many other cities and many other regions of the world. So I think that we'll go through that process and we'll see exactly what we do and where we go. But it is our intention to be in a city for a couple of years and then move somewhere else so that we move it around like a World Cup.
I think a lot of people would be interested in the way that the ITF works with Cosmos on this. Who is making the decisions? Who is running this event, basically? And how does that all work in comparison to how it used to work?
So it's a partnership of the ITF and Cosmos working together. We have licensed various rights to Cosmos, such as the sponsorship, the broadcast rights. But when it comes to what happens on the court, the operational technical aspects, that's the ITF leading on those sorts of decisions, where the commercial decisions are more led by Cosmos. But we have a steering committee made up of Gerard and I and two other, one ITF and one Cosmos person, that discuss all the high-level issues that might arise if they're not handled at the local operating level between the ITF and Cosmos. And again, we've had a good relationship. We don't always agree on everything, but I think we come to a decision at the end, and so that's kind of how it works.
And how involved is Gerard Piqué? Is he a decision maker, or is he more of a figurehead?
No, Gerard is very, very involved. I mean, as am I. But I think usually we're involved on the strategic elements and or decisions that are complex and being made is when we get most involved. We have strong teams. Javier Alonso from Cosmos and Kelly Fairweather from the ITF spend a lot of time working together, and then the teams that each group has work together on a constant basis.
Just looking ahead to the future, Novak Djokovic has said this week, and I think thoughts echoed by Rafael Nadal as well, that he doesn't think that the ATP Cup and the Davis Cup can coexist, in his words. What is the ITF's position on that? Do you think that the best thing for tennis would be a merge of those two competitions?
So, the ITF and ATP have had a series of meetings over the years. There's been recent leadership change at the ATP, so we will re-engage. We had an election. I was re-elected. So now that our leadership on both sides is defined, I think we sit down and look at what's best for tennis. I don't know what that means and what the outcome will be. But the great thing was both Novak and Rob of being here and playing in the Davis Cup and being committed to it. We want to do what's right for the calendar and for the players, so we'll involve them and look forward to collaboration with the ATP, and we'll see what that might lead to.
Do you anticipate those talks starting right in the new year?
Yes, I would imagine that we'll have meetings in Melbourne, if not before before we get there.
Just finally, it does seem that the women have been quite left out of this whole team competition. Obviously, I know the ICF have reformed the Fed Cup, and we'll see the first edition of that in Budapest next year. But thinking long term, do you think that a combined mixed team event is the best thing for tennis? And is that your kind of ultimate ambition to involve them? Because from my point of view, you've talked about a kind of festival of tennis. The Grand Slams feel like festivals of tennis when everyone is involved together. And so is that your intention to work towards that in the future?
Well, I think that I do agree that when we have men and women together, it is a fantastic event. And we talked about doing that, about 2 years ago, of having a mixed competition. The issue was calendar, so I think we still need to work through with both. But what we wanted to do was make sure for Fed Cup that we immediately got to a equal prize money position as quickly as we could, which is for next year, which is very important. And we also have our Hopman Cup mixed competition that we'll be reintroducing in 2021. So we're going through a bid process because we know that when eight nations come together, one man, one woman playing singles, then playing mixed doubles, it's exciting. So that's something that we'll be bringing back. And then as a longer-term goal, I think having both Davis Cup and Fed Cup together at the right time in the calendar would be fantastic.
So we can expect to see Hopman Cup back on the calendar in 2021?
Yes, you can.
Cosmos haven't invested in the new Fed Cup. So what is their position on women's tennis? Because it kind of feels like you two are obviously working together on this, but if Cosmos are less interested in the women's tennis, how is that going to work in the future?
Well, actually, Cosmos has always been interested in the women's competition. I think that together we decided that for the first edition for 3 years in Budapest, that we would be working on that from an ITF perspective, while they work on Davis Cup, which is a big project, as you know. So I think down the road, there's possibilities that we bring it all together and then have this mixed competition, Davis Cup and Fed Cup, together down the road. But I think it's going to take us a little bit of time to get there, especially as you look at schedules and working with two tours and the ITF and Cosmos in order to do that.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time, David.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, Matt, I think you asked him just about every question we've ever wanted to ask him. So great job with that interview. I think you did a fantastic job with it. It's interesting. There were some questions in there that I didn't feel were wholly satisfactory in the answers that you got. I personally don't understand the wild card thing. I mean, look, the bottom line is the reason they've got wild cards is to make sure they get a couple of countries in that they really need to get in case they don't qualify. And whilst I understand that, and part of me thinks that's just not the competition. I know we have wild cards in tennis as a rule. We have wild cards in Grand Slam. So maybe you could make the argument that it's just in line with that. It doesn't feel right to me in this instance. There was also the one, and I really do struggle with it, with the spending time more than a year in the same country as a host nation, because as we've seen, I know Rafael Nadal is Superman, but he was also backed by 12,500 people, creating an incredible atmosphere. And that's great. We want that. But should the same country have that more than 1 year? I don't think so. It was just really good to be able to have a chance to sit down, though, with David Haggerty. I'm glad that he was available to speak to you, that you got to put some very straightforward questions to him, and our listeners can make up their own minds as to what they've heard.
Yeah, there was a very brief suggestion that we might get to speak to PK, but then he had to go off and see the king.
You got dumped for the king.
Yeah, had to play second fiddle to the king.
Who looked really tense, by the way. During
Gerald Piqué is
the
just
final, they kept cutting away into Prince, the King Felipe.
Oh,
he, right, yeah, well, not a good poker face, Felipe.
Okay, Gerard, we'll try not to be too put out by it all. after calling you personable and all that. Not so sure now. Anyway, I'll try and get over that. And let's hear from Chris Clary, because Matt has been speaking to the tennis correspondent of the New York Times.
Chris, we're sitting here in the dark, actually, in a dark room. But for the first time this week, I think I'm recording podcast before about 1 a.m. in the morning. We've had some pretty late nights here, haven't we? How are you?
I'm good. I think the darkness is appropriate. This is, I feel like I wrote this the other day. I feel like I should be hanging from my feet when I sleep here. It's been definitely for vampires only. It's been a lot of late nights.
Yeah, absolutely. What are your general impressions of the week so far?
Yeah, they're really mixed, but they're mixed in kind of a strong way. I would say the ingredients are sort of strong ingredients. In one way, the ends of the matches and some of the scenes have been very powerful. As powerful as anything you would see in tennis, frankly. I've been covering Davis Cup since the late 80s, so I've seen a lot of different scenes over the years, and there's been some real, you know, genuine, powerful emotion from Serbia, from Spain, from Rafa, different people, the Canadians. The negative is that there's been an awful lot of lost moments, I think, too, and lost content, particularly in the front end of this with the group round-robin phase. You know, really zero atmosphere in some matches, and some great matchups. U.S.-Canada, for example, at this stage of the game, you know, with it's a North American tennis rivalry waiting to happen. Mm. You put that in either one of our countries at this point, especially in Canada, would have been a big deal for 2 or 3 days. And here it was just lost, virtually nothing. So that to me has to be fixed. So that's the thing that troubles me. And I also feel like, you know, I'm joking, and you are too, about the darkness. But, I mean, it's not a joke. I mean, I was in there at 4:04 a.m. watching the end of this match the other night with the U.S., and that just can't happen.
It's good for no one, is it? Fans, players, media. It's just, you can't run a tournament like that sustainably long term. It's just that has to be changed. Would you say that's perhaps the main thing that they need to get right next year, is the scheduling?
Well, I think that's probably, in some ways, if they don't want to change the format in a more significant way, that's job one for sure. But, you know, there's a lot of other jobs too. I mean, there's a lot to do here. I don't think it's in any way a failure, but it's certainly at best a qualified success, I would say. And we'll see how the scene is, you know, as we look at this thing after it's all over. But my feeling is that it's there's a lot of work to do. And I wasn't terribly impressed by how they came out of the gate, considering they had a fair amount of time to plan this. Mm. And the ITF's been involved as well with Cosmos, who had the rights. So I think that's disappointing, but they did make some good adjustments during the week, and they showed some nimble behavior there. So we'll see.
Yeah, they pushed the start times forward, didn't they, in the morning and in the afternoon, albeit only half an hour. We were getting to bed at 2 rather than 2:30, but it showed a willingness to make some changes and a recognition that there were some things that they were getting wrong. I've kind of felt that maybe it's been more of a success than a lot of the doubters thought it would be, but it hasn't been as much as a success as the organizers, the creators had hoped it would be. Would you say that's a kind of fair assessment?
Yeah, and I think a lot will depend on what the numbers are really truly are in terms of the television coverage around the world. I know in the U.S. it was basically non-existent. I saw some of the numbers for France, which is a Davis Cup country. Obviously, they were resistors to this concept in a lot of ways. Not all the players, to be fair, but the majority of the players there were. And the numbers for the television in France were very poor. So I think we'll see how that goes. That'll give them an idea. But in the U.S., Davis Cup was already in serious decline, and this will make it non-existent if they keep it like this.
And that's really significant, because part of the change was to try and improve the situation and the prestige around Davis Cup and get more people interested in it. So can you just talk a little bit about what is the TV situation in the U.S.? Why haven't people been able to watch it?
Well, in U.S. tennis, as you know, is a niche sport. It's not a mainstream sport, except for maybe U.S. Open time and then arguably Wimbledon still. But basically Tennis Channel, which is dedicated to the sport year-round, has carved out a decent niche on Davis Cup in the last decade or so, and they've been able to at least become an appointment viewing for people who are interested in that and not just focus on the U.S., kind of give it a global view. And they didn't get the rights to this. From what I heard, the rights fee that Cosmos was asking for was quite high. Not a great week in the U.S. or great timing. obviously a lot of the matches are happening during the night in the U.S. window. So Tennis Channel didn't bite, didn't go for it. They ended up getting them to Fox Sports 2, which is one of the subsidiary channels of Fox Sports. A lot of households don't get that in the U.S. There's no identification with tennis in that channel. And they only took the U.S. matches and the final on Sunday. So if you had, great matches like the semis were on Saturday, no way to watch that on any kind of television, cable, terrestrial. Only way to do it was through streaming. And the streaming site was Rakuten Sports through the sponsorship. And I can guarantee you that less than 1% of Americans know what Rakuten Sports is. So really not ideal in any way. Not that we're the market you need to make your choices on. Davis Cup in the U.S. is not a great brand these days, but certainly not a way to build it.
Mm. And just being here, you've obviously covered a lot of Davis Cup in your career. Has it felt like Davis Cup to you? Have they got it right conceptually?
I think the scenes of player emotion, the intensity of the tennis that's being played, it is similar to Davis Cup in that approach. And I do feel the sense of playing for your flag, and that distinctive quality is still there. However, the fact that it's so condensed, I think, robs us of some of its long-form power. And the fact that there is so much going on at the same time makes it difficult. I mean, you can argue, on the old format, if you're playing first-round matches all over the world at the same time, then, of course, you're conflicting with each other as well. But it felt like with the 3 days of those formats, you had a way to kind of absorb what was happening, move on to the next day, who's playing doubles, move on to the final day and the reverse singles. This is all happening in a hurry. So it almost feels like it's too rushed. People like me who've been following Davis Cup for so long and remember those epic, epic matches. But maybe, I'm 54 years old, and so my sense of what's entertainment and where the power is perhaps different than somebody that they're targeting. And I can definitely say that, the emotions were powerful at the end, and that's really the most important thing. And also it's great to see, I think, that the doubles turned out to be so important this week, although it could be very unimportant if you end up with matches that are 2-0 after the singles.
There's a trade-off with the doubles, isn't there? Sometimes it's going to be a dead rubber in this new format, and sometimes it's going to be the most important match. Personally, we've been talking about that quite a lot on the podcast this week. We're all kind of in favour of it. We think it actually ends up giving a little bit more prominence to the doubles, even though sometimes you do get a dead rubbers, but five of the last six ties, as we talked just before the final, have gone to the deciding doubles, and it really has felt significant, both seeing specialist doubles teams, but also some singles guys stepping in and trying to try their hand at doubles.
Yeah, and that's the advantage to this one-week bring-everybody-together format, because you're going to lose a few doubles matches that aren't going to happen, hopefully not with a six-love result and a walkover, which was, not very sporting and not really right for the format. They'll fix that, I think. But because you have so many matches, you're going to lose some doubles, but you're going to inevitably have quite a few. And if you can get people like Rafa and Novak playing in those matches, or people like Medvedev down the road, if they come back and play again, that's great. That really elevates doubles. And I think, best of five for doubles is a lot.
Mm.
Best of three is great.
Yeah.
And I think it really, really worked. Other years they keep this format, it won't work as well, but it will always work to some degree.
So we've talked about some of the issues, the scheduling. We haven't talked about necessarily the kind of live scores at the website, which just wasn't really prepared for the traffic. And do you think those are the kind of teething problems that they can solve? Or are you more worried about kind of their competence at running this event long term? How do you see it playing out next year?
Jury's out on that. As you said before, I think we were reassured by their eagerness and attempt to try to fix things along the way, but they certainly didn't get it all right by the end. And frankly, for an organization to start off a major event like this with the technology in such a poor state is really inexcusable, I think. Really, you're not talking about a startup here entirely. You have carryover from the ITF and previous Davis Cups, and either they didn't use the expertise they had appropriately, they tried to outsource it, or they tried to reinvent the wheel, but the reinvention didn't work very well. So yeah, for sure the confidence is a bit shaken. And I think they need to really have a great second edition to consolidate this thing.
And can this event work in its current guise without Spain doing so well and without Rafa Nadal carrying it? Because we have, it has felt to me like the really special moments have been when Spain have been playing on that main court, Nadal's been leading. If Spain had gone out in the groups, do you think we would be having a more negative spin on this competition? Are they relying on the host nation doing well in these tournaments?
I don't know how much pre-sale they had for the final weekend, but my suspicion is yes, it would be much more downbeat sort of thing. But I would say for me, the most powerful thing that I've seen was the end of the Serbia match when they lost to Russia. And that was apart from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
But you could argue that was basically Davis Cup nostalgia at work as opposed to Davis Cup reality in the moment at work, because the Serbs have all the memories of winning in 2010, mm-hmm. all the team spirit that they built. They were running on Davis Cup fumes of the past and all that, not so much on what this event itself was creating. The Canadians, it's a different story. The Canadians, it's really all about right here,
mm-hmm.
right now. But in terms of Spain, hey, I think it's great that you have a home team. Not that Spain deserved it. They didn't earn it, but they got it because of the way the negotiations went. But in no way do I subscribe to the idea that it's a good idea to have this thing in Madrid beyond next year. They're talking about adding a third year already. Mm-hmm. That's, to me, the wrong method and the wrong approach. You can't have Spain be the permanent home team for the Davis Cup. It doesn't work.
Is there any kind of argument that if they were to hold it here an extra year, they can kind of grow a bit more momentum behind it and really get people knowing what it is before they move it on? Do you think one more year will be enough?
The Davis Cup has got to spread the wealth around on the home court advantage to be relevant and to have integrity. That's just part of the deal. Spain obviously has a huge home court advantage. They're not playing on clay, which would be their best surface, but there's still a huge advantage. You can feel it. Rafa was well aware. Critical moments, he tapped into it very, very intentionally, and it worked. And Davis Cup records, you look back at the record book for 100-plus years, the home court advantage is huge. So maybe in this very rare case of starting this up again in a new way, you could perhaps justify a third year. But my concern would be that would be consolidating it to the point where it wants to stay longer. And then I just don't see the point of calling it Davis Cup or pretending it's going to be a neutral event where each nation has an equal chance.
Do you have any sense of where it might go beyond after Spain?
Well, I give Gerard Piqué credit in that he keeps talking about the desire to consolidate this with the ATP. I interviewed Piqué just once at length, and I was surprised. I kind of went in thinking he was going to give me a PR line of thinking and kind of answer my questions like a good central defender, flicking the ball away out of trouble. But no, he actually answered them pretty openly, and he was asked today about Federer and conceded that he was a little bit mystified by the fact that there hadn't been more communication about the Laver Cup. And I'm sure there's another side to that story, knowing Roger and his agent, Tony Gottsick. But it seems like there really is a desire to try to bring these things together. But this architecture that's in place now, with the Australians having taken their preseason, basically, and reworked the whole thing, going to be hard to put that genie back in the bottle afterward. So it's hard to imagine that they're going to get the ATP Cup just to give up their spot now, come together with them. But I certainly could see the Davis Cup moving to a different part of the year, maybe changing the number of teams involved. I personally would like to see it be not 18 teams in a final phase, but maximum 8.
Okay.
That's just my own personal view. There is a chance we're going to see some consolidation down the road. I know that the intent from the ITF and Cosmos is to try to make that happen, but I have my doubts. Once you see the ATP Cup in action as part of the Australian vibe in January, it may be hard to undo.
That was something Djokovic was saying, that maybe he thinks the change is slightly too radical almost, and he might have gone with two rounds of home and away and then a kind of elite eight, like you were saying. Can you imagine them doing that in the future, or is it just still too early to say?
There are so many opinions on this thing. I will say that I was one of the big proponents for change of the Davis Cup, grudgingly, because I love the event, but I could just sense it was losing steam and that the final was becoming more and more a local thing, and that the top players just were not clashing in the Davis Cup enough to give it relevance going forward. Obviously, a lot of pushback on that over the years. But my theory was I felt like a Final Four was really the ideal option, if you're going to make one change to start, I would never have gone for the 18-team aspect. They did keep the one round in February as sort of a vestige of Davis Cup past, which I think is good. But ultimately, Davis Cup still needs to be something that can grow the game around the world. And I remember myself, I mean, I grew up in Southern California and Hawaii. I got to watch Davis Cup matches between the U.S. and France in San Diego, of all places, because France came to play the U.S. in Davis Cup. Never would I have seen those players any other way. And there are many people that would say the same. And so I think if you were able to create two rounds each year, let's say 3 weeks of tennis for the Davis Cup or World Cup, whatever you want to call it, then you have a real substantive chance to really move the tournament to some places it wouldn't otherwise go and give people a feel on different things without totally uprooting the calendar. And then you have one final phase, be it eight, be it four. Mm-hmm. So I really like that idea.
Yeah, I like that.
And on top of that, we're talking about already with these weeks that the ITF had from the previous Davis Cup, doing something like a winner-take-all singles tournament, Majesty Cup, which I just detest that idea. That's just counter everything tennis needs right now. So if you're going to use that week for that, by God, use it for a Davis Cup week, and let's do that, you know?
And you were saying about how it's been pretty poor, the fact that they've got some things so dramatically wrong here. Do you get the sense that with Tennis Australia backing it, the ATP Cup might be almost a kind of smoothed out version of this, except without all the feel and the passion and the emotion? Do you think from a kind of organization point of view, it might run more smoothly?
I don't know. I would suspect so, yes, because there's also the Tennis Australia has been very involved in Laver Cup, intimately involved. So they've seen how that kind of an event operates. They've worked through a lot of bugs with that. They've become big organizers of events through their own Australian summer season. A lot of expertise there. I don't see them getting the website and the app and those things wrong. ATP's got expertise there too. So I think they will benefit from seeing where this one went wrong, but they already have a lot of, I think, strengths in place that would allow them to succeed. So yes, and it is going to be strange because they are going to seem very similar. This is a federation-based event where the nations really and the structure of the tennis in each country is important. That's going to be really about the players. But will the public make that distinction? Will that nuance seem important to them? I don't know. There'll be plenty of hugging and celebrating, maybe even a few tears. And then you're going to go bang right into this great event. Whereas this kind of, having not been major around the world, kind of drifts off into the off-season. And then when the ATP Cup happens, it's going to be all brightly colored and exciting in that way.
Just to reflect a little bit more on this week, what you mentioned, the Serbia-Russia tie. Any other standout moments for you?
Well, I think, you know, from a U.S. perspective, we are definitely in a rebuild mode for men's tennis. Women's tennis in my country is doing tremendously well, as you know. So much excitement about the future with Coco Gauff and Amanda Anisimova and other players. And obviously Serena is still playing. So women's tennis kind of rules the media landscape in the U.S. right now. But some of these men coming up are interesting. And I think Taylor Fritz showed me a lot. In that late night match in singles, the reason the late night match in doubles happened is because Taylor Fritz, you know, came back and managed to win against Berrettini. So that was for him, I think, a good character check. And I saw a lot of good things in him there that could lead to I think having some good results in the nearer term, next couple of years. So that was fun for me to see that up close, to sort of feel the grit. And I just enjoyed, really enjoyed plugging into the doubles and just watching the way doubles is played, honestly, because at the Grand Slams, I mean, this doesn't speak well of me, but I rarely have time to watch doubles in depth because I'm so busy with the singles and covering the tournament. To get a real chance to look really at how it's being played and to really appreciate the nuances of that has been a pleasure.
And just, you mentioned the women there. We're always talking about how we think the absolute ideal team event is a combined team event where, you know, men and women are together. We think tennis is strongest when it's the men and women together, like the slams. Do you sense that might be somewhere down the road, or is that even more complicated politics?
I thought that was what we were going to be doing here initially. If you recall a couple of years ago, nobody will recall this probably, but Dave Haggerty, the president of the ITF, basically announced that they were going to do a joint, you know, Davis Cup final and a Final Four Fed Cup together. That was going to be... Well, it turned out to be a little bit premature and and kind of unilateral. And actually, I think the board of the ITF actually approved that. So that was, And that was what I thought was a great idea. I love that. I don't love 18 women's teams and 18 men's teams all coming together for 2 weeks. I think that's too much content, too much stuff. But again, if you can put them together, yeah, absolutely. I think tennis has this huge advantage in sport because they were ahead of the curve on integrating men and women together in a meaningful way. It's part of the DNA of the sport now. Other sports are scrambling to replicate that. I hear golf talking about trying to have joint majors at the same time. Obviously, women's football is just going gangbusters all over the world now, especially in Europe. You'll see this huge push to integrate the two. Tennis is already there. Why squander that?
Is there any danger of the fact that because tennis has been the leader, it's resting on its laurels a little bit in that regard and not pushing harder, pushing for even more?
Yes, I think that's true. And I think also, you know, I think the men have been resistant to some of these merger concepts because they feel like they've been driving more of the revenue over time and the ATP wants to keep its independence. I understand that. But if you're being visionary about it, and visionary is not always tennis's thing, unfortunately, I think, you know, combining the WTA and the ATP together, working together, make us one product and have the synergies and take the sport forward that way. I think it'd be a great way to go. And I really believe, and I'm not just saying this because it's politically convenient, I think women's sport's going to continue to rise. And I think to have them together, I think the men will be happy ultimately that they're together with them. I think this thing could really flip in 20 years in a very interesting way.
That is really interesting. Just a final note, have you covered Davis Cup finals in recent years, or is this the first one for you in a while, or, you know, has it changed the way you're covering this event, the change in format?
You know, I covered it almost every year in the 90s and the early 2000s. Then I basically, the last one I covered as a final was the Swiss final against the French when the Swiss won with Federer and Wawrinka. So it's been a few years now. So I'm coming into it with a lot of background, but not so much the most recent ones live. I haven't seen the British finals and things like that. So my sense of it is that compared to what I saw before in finals, there's more potential here.
I mean, I was at the Davis Cup final last year in Lille, and, you know, there was nowhere near as many press as I hear now. From a media perspective, do you kind of think that this concept is better? It just needs some improvements?
Well, there's two things that work there. By bringing so many nations together, obviously you're going to be pulling in and tying it into the Davis Cup tradition. Whether this should or should not be called Davis Cup is yet to be determined. I've heard a lot of people arguing against it. I can see their point. But if you're going to keep that approach and this is national team, you're going to pull in a lot of people. But that's also the first year. So it's a novelty effect. I mean, if there's no coverage in my country of any sort next year, it's equivalent to this year. Having seen what it's already like, it's not a automatic that I'll cover it, for example. I would think so, but you never know. And I think it'll be interesting to see how many people are return customers in that end of it. But for sure, with the wide variety of nations, you're going to bring in more media for that. And that really, to their credit, is one of the big goals of this. Take an event. Davis Cup was international, as you know, at the beginning of the rounds, all over the world, dots on the map, kind of got more and more narrow as it went along. If you ever would have had that great Rafa-Roger final, Spain-Switzerland, or that great Novak-Rafa final, it would have gone big again. It has never happened. So it's always gone down to this very intense, bi-national sort of thing. And that's, for the way the world works, for a big event, it's not going to be sustainable. So they're trying to change that, but they got to get the media right and the TV rights right, and they've got to get the format to the point where it's, you're not losing content.
Well, between Chris Clary and Mary Carrillo, I feel like we have got the most fantastic satellite parts to this podcast that we've added over the last few years. Of course, Matt being the best one of the lot. And again, just a really interesting conversation. Catherine, what did you think of all that?
Goodness me. Yeah. I mean, I'm just always fascinated by the way Chris's mind works and the takes that he has on things, not just because he's a great mind, but sort of that in conjunction with his rich appreciation of the history of tennis is just a very special and unique thing. I think that, I mean, sort of hearing what he had to say in conjunction with what we've just heard from Haggerty, you know, I don't think it does the tournament, the ITF, the Davis Cup, any favours to pretend that things like the cock up with the website and the app is anything other than a big cock up. You know, I liked that. I really sort of appreciated how no nonsense Chris was about that. You know, it's not good enough, but it's also easily put right. You know, it's a lot easier to sort that stuff out than it is to sort out the heart and soul of the tournament, which thankfully, mercifully, was there and was on display from the players. You've got that, but sort, you know, don't bury your head in the sand about the other things. And his take on the Laver Cup and upcoming ATP Cup were very interesting, and sort of without using the phrase, he kind of touched upon the tendency towards recency bias that we all have, right? You know, he's at the moment we're all saying, yeah, Davis Cup was great, and doesn't it feel silly that we're going to have the ATP Cup in 6 weeks' time? But probably when the ATP Cup comes around, and knowing what we do about those that are running it, you know, a lot of the same entities involved as with Laver Cup, it's going to be a big, shiny, glossy thing, and we're all going to sort of get wrapped up in that and think, oh, that was really good. So, and then what are we going to be left?
Not sure we will. I'm not sure I will. To me, it'll end up feeling like an Australian Open warm-up.
Yeah. But I mean, but as I remember Matt saying at the time of the Laver Cup, that it really resonates at the time, but you forget it quickly. Mm. And nobody, when they're announcing Federer onto court, is describing him as a three-time Laver Cup winner. You know, it doesn't resonate, and that doesn't mean that it's not great in the moment and doesn't have a place, but it doesn't leave a lasting impact. And I suspect that will be the case with ATP Cup. It'll have a lot of gloss, it'll be a lot of fun, it'll be cool, but it won't leave an impact. Whereas I do think elements of what we've seen this week will endure.
Yeah, I won't forget that the audio that we had from that Serbian press conference in a hurry. That was beyond what you see on a daily basis on the tour.
And it's UK geographical and probably European centric point of view that I'm about to make here. But I think one of the tests with the ATP Cup will come just whether we kind of bother staying up for it or waking up early for it. You know, it's going to be on in the middle of the night. So how much of it are we going to see? We're going to really have to make quite an effort, I think, to watch it. And start of the season, a competition that, you know, in my opinion, doesn't really mean anything at the moment. I don't know whether I'll be, how much of that I'll be making sure that I watch. Whereas I feel like even if the Davis Cup were to move somewhere, I would make sure I tuned in, because it's already got that history, that base, that grounding, to be honest.
I think it'll be interesting to see what the players are like with the ATP Cup, because what they've managed to do very successfully with the Laver Cup is give you the feeling that everybody's caring about it at the time. Even though it feels like a real stretch to me with Europe against the rest of the world, it's like the players have almost got there and they've just decided, these are my mates, I'm wearing blue or I'm wearing red, and that's the thing. With the Davis Cup, it's just very clear. It's your country. Mm. And I've felt totally swept up this week with that element of it. It is instantly tapped into that. Now, ATP Cup is supposedly the same thing. I can't envisage caring that much who wins. But I wonder how big a deal that will be with the players.
And I think what Chris was saying about how 18 teams perhaps feels like a few too many at the Davis Cup. Well, there's 24 at the ATP Cup, and there are there are a lot of players at the ATP Cup. You know, we've seen the entry lists who, you know, have four-digit rankings, to be quite honest.
We were going to play bingo with the entry list, weren't we? Except it wouldn't have lasted very long because an awful lot of names on there that nobody knew. And there's this bizarre situation where it's teams of five, but it's only the top two singles players. There's essentially no value in the, and this is a point that Riley Opelka was making this week and others have as well, but Riley Opelka really spoke well about it, I thought. There's just absolutely no value in the number three from a country playing the ATP Cup because they won't play any matches, basically, unless someone gets injured. And I do wonder how many matches are we going to be watching or not watching, as the case may be, from the ATP Cup that's Martin Cuevas against Buster Dimitrov. One of those two people is real, folks.
Buster.
Genuinely.
I love how Buster came to you.
It's a bit like one of those where you sort of try to imagine what name you would give yourself if you could give yourself your own nickname.
The point I'm tiredly making is that there's an awful lot of people's brothers that have snuck into the ATP Cup draw that you never knew played tennis or existed. But here they are.
Yeah, correct.
No Moritz team, though.
Well, but maybe there's some sort of technicality that he can just slide in on. I don't know.
But yeah, look, we are not going to see scenes like we've seen at the Davis Cup this week in terms of the big beating heart, because you can't create that out of nowhere.
No,
you can't.
But I am interested to see. You know, I'll try and keep an open mind. But in answer to your question, Matt, I suspect I'll be sort of fitting it in when I can. I won't be going searching. I won't be staying up at 4 in the morning and having my breakfast before I go to bed.
Well,
put it that way.
We're not doing daily podcasts, are we? Are we?
No, we're not. No, we're not. However, we have just booked Catherine and Matt's flights to Australia shortly before the Australian Open starts, where we will be bringing you daily editions throughout the Australian Open, the French Open, Wimbledon, US Open. I say this, provided we manage to kickstart ourselves on the 2nd of December when we launch our crowdfunding. But, you know, we always have in the past. You have always supported us so generously. And we hope we have grown our audience enough so that more people feel that they can pitch in and help to support the Tennis Podcast and keep it going and growing. That's the goal. Matt, you've been a legend over the last week. We cannot believe how well you've done, and the hours you've put in, the content you've been able to get for us, the interviews you got, even just today. I mean, I can't tell you how tricky it is to try to play the role of producer and interviewer at the same time whilst you've basically had about 4 hours sleep nightly all week long, and then still did the podcast with us. I mean, brilliant job, and I hope you've enjoyed
it. Does he remind you of anyone, David?
Well, you know, they do start say that dogs start to look like their owners, don't they? So Matt's starting to turn into me, I think.
Well, I was highly stressed today, I must say.
Were you?
Yeah, I had technical problems. I actually, that interview that I did with Chris, we did in a completely pitch black room. You know, honest. I hope that doesn't come across, but I could barely see his face. He could barely see mine. I had my torch on my phone to kind of look at my recording device. It looked a bit like that when we emerged from this dark room and there was people standing outside. They must have been wondering what we were doing in there for half an hour.
Why didn't you turn the light on?
The light didn't work, and it was the only quiet space we could find.
What did he say when you ushered him into the dark room?
Chris led us there.
Hit record.
Chris was handling the whole where do we record situation much better than I was.
He said, oh, I know this really good place. Follow me.
Exactly.
What I love is that Matt has finally arrived now at the Tennis Podcast, because you haven't arrived until you come out of a great interview and go, it hasn't recorded, or the sound's rubbish. What am I going to do? And that.
What's this weird hiss?
Yeah, that's happened a lot.
Which is the story of our French Open.
Yes, yeah. It was some serious flashbacks.
What is that weird hiss?
I don't know. But anyway, thanks to...
Is David going to notice that weird hiss?
Thanks to the genius that is our producer, Patrick, we've managed to sort it all out. And so there you have the lovely interview that Matt did with Chris Clary. So well done, Matt. Hope you've enjoyed it. Have you enjoyed it?
Very much, yeah. It's been one of the more intense weeks of tennis I think I've ever experienced. And I've been constantly weighing up what are just the glitches and what are the kind of real problems with the tournament. But I think I definitely fall on your side, and I think Chris's side as well, that overall it's been a positive, and they can correct a lot of the things, but they need to. We will be judging them far more strongly, I think, next year. But as a kind of one-off week of tennis experience, it really has been really special to be here.
Yeah. And look, I've said it a couple of times. I'll say it one more time. Yes, we did take sponsorship from the Davis Cup in the run-up to this event. I know some people don't think we should or think it might have compromised our views. I think by doing an interview the way we have there and giving our views as honestly held as we possibly could all week, because frankly we have been unfiltered, I think you can probably tell that that has not influenced things in our regard at all. Tomorrow... we're going to go to see Andy Murray resurfacing the documentary about his comeback. All three of us. That's going to be good, isn't it? We just need to get Matt home in time.
We're going to a premiere.
Yeah. It's out on Friday. If you want to watch it worldwide, you better watch it. And we're going to go and have a watch tomorrow. Sneak preview. It's the first thing I've ever had a sneak preview of.
Mm. Matt is flying home from his assignment in Madrid and going straight to a premiere. What are you, Matt?
What is this life?
I am not worthy.
We've plunged you into a life a bit different to eating economy fish fingers at university. And that was
given
my
that
life.
We're not given that we're not recording a podcast for a week.
Yes.
Is it a week?
We're going to record one after Tennis Podcast Live, aren't we, on the 2nd?
Should we end on updating people on Stefanos Tsitsipas's social media activity?
Go on, then.
Go for it.
He's been in Iceland, folks. He's had a transcendent holiday experience in Iceland, which is quite different to the experience I had in Iceland. But... maybe he saw the whole shebang and not just the pale green haze. He has concluded his experience by posting a picture of himself. Where is he in this picture?
I thought he was sitting in an air conditioning tunnel.
Yeah, it's a tunnel, right? It looks like he's in a kind of Mission Impossible film or something, but dressed really weirdly.
It looks like he's been hired to complete the final phase of Crossrail. He's wearing sort of high vis, in a tunnel, looking intense and moody,
meaningful.
And he has the following to say. Brace yourself, folks. This is profound. My trip to this unrealistic piece of land, the so-called Iceland, has come to an end, but. This is not me reading it badly. I'm trying to read it as he has punctuated it. But I see it more as a beginning, a starting point. I witness things with my eyes, surrounded by beauty and pleasantness. A journey which educated me and made me love even more. I feel fortunate to be living life with such entity. It was more than photographs of beautiful landscapes, breathtaking sceneries and gracious people that made me feel things as a person. This was more of a fragrance enhanced with adoration. A sense of achievement. This Icelandic odyssey, that's in quotation marks, was something extraordinary. A cold body carries a warm heart. That's something that I learnt from this trip. By the way, I feel like a Viking now.
Do you know what I really want to do? I really want to mash up that you've just read with your description of Iceland at Wimbledon and just play them side by side and, you know, put it on some completely, you know, some neutral tourist board site saying your experience will be one of these two things. Your life will be changed either way, for the better or the worse.
Same place, different views.
Yeah.
Can we just be clear?
Yeah,
we think he's magnificent.
He's like a real life Instagram filter, isn't it? It's like I had the real life experience of Iceland, and then you pass it through an Instagram filter, and you get Stefanos Tsitsipas's life altering, earth shattering experience.
Or did he have the real one, and you were the filter?
I don't know. There were a lot of people on that coach with me that also saw only a pale green haze and had to enjoy the journey back with the broken door in minus 20 degrees at 2 o'clock in the morning after having just been told that you've seen the Northern Lights whilst feeling really quite significantly shortchanged and drinking a really sad miniature bottle of wine that you bought from a sort of like Aldi.
Didn't you say that Stefanos Tsitsipas could have a life-enhancing experience in Aldi?
I did, yeah. I really feel like he could go to Asda and have a transcendental experience. I do.
Him and me both.
He could walk the dog and change his life.
Yeah. Go on, Steph. Optimism.
Guys, I've experienced a new life of entity.
I'm not even sure what that means.
I've found a way to live life with an enhanced fragrance.
Second language.
He knows all the words. I mean, he's got a better vocabulary than me.
Oh, he's fantastic.
It's just the way the sequence in which it comes out is so special.
It's different.
It's just great. Oh,
long may you continue.
He's the person at a party that thinks every song is about him. Oh my God, this is totally about me.
We love you, Steph. Right.
Don't ever change.
Don't ever change.
Can you imagine if he changed and became corporate? It would be the saddest thing in the whole world.
Or even became. Please don't ever
don't
change.
Even
become self-aware. Just keep doing this. It's just great. Just enjoy your life and
there's
be
about
you.
Sort of 15 steps before corporate.
Yes, I think we've got a bit of wriggle room. So, right then, we've been the Tennis Podcast. Brought to you in association with The Telegraph, executive produced by TennisBalls.com. Our mascot is Rio with a Y. For just a couple of weeks longer, we've loved having Rio with a Y. But it's new mascots, it's new year coming your way very soon, and hopefully loads and loads of new tennis podcasts. So I hope you've enjoyed them. That's it for daily editions of The Tennis Podcast, unless I think of something that's a really good idea between now and December the 31st. But yeah, we've been daily at the Australian Open, the French Open, Wimbledon, US Open, Queens, ATP Finals, WTA Finals, Fed Cup Final, Davis Cup Finals.
Bloody hell.
No, there have been certain...
And David has started having to eat breakfast before he goes to bed.
There have been certain moments where they've refused to speak to me because of all this. But they love it, really. And so, yeah, we want to do the same next year if we can. Thanks for listening to us and for all the lovely messages of support. We've had some really, really nice messages and emails and we read them all and they're really nice. And thank you. And we'll speak to you soon.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.